Good morning. This is Northern Light for Tuesday, April 2nd. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe.
School districts in New York have to switch to all-electric buses by 2035. It's drawn the ire of districts and Republican lawmakers.
Just because you're asking questions and saying, hey, I want to make sure that the math works and that we're doing the right thing here, does not mean that you're a climate change denier or you don't love the environment. It's that you respect the safety of school kids, the value of the taxpayers' money.
Today, we visit the first district to get electric buses on the road, Alex Bay.
All the prisons in New York State will go on a 3-hour lockdown during the total solar eclipse on Monday. The state says it's for safety, but advocates say it could do the opposite.
Even if in the short term a total lockdown means that nothing is going to happen, we know that, you know, facilitating positive experiences is a way to reduce violence, not just among incarcerated people, but towards staff as well.
And you've got questions about the science of the total solar eclipse.
I was wondering how long astronomers have been able to predict eclipses. I think I've heard they've been able to do this for centuries.
And
I'm also wondering how they've been able to predict solar eclipses without our modern tools.
Astronomer Eileen O'Donohue joins us with the answers. Coming up here on Northern Light, stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Fisher, Bissett, Muldowney, and McArdle, attorneys and counselors at law with offices in Malone, Tupper Lake, and Saranac Lake. 800-941-5001. And by Adirondack Foundation, connecting people, ideas, and resources to improve lives and expand opportunities throughout the Adirondack region. Details at adirondackfoundation.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. Last year's state budget set a mandate requiring that all New York school districts replace their gas and diesel buses with electric school buses by 2035. That's about 50,000 school buses statewide. It's an ambitious target aligned with New York's equally ambitious climate goals.
It's also been the subject of pushback and criticism from school districts and Republican lawmakers for being unrealistic and one size fits all. One of the few school districts in the North Country that started electrifying their school bus fleet is in Jefferson County. Amy Feiereisel reports.
Here in the Alexandria Bay Central School District bus garage, they're going through a transition from conventional gas and diesel buses to electric buses. And it's not always easy.
There for about 4 or 5 months, I was pulling my hair out. You know, this wasn't something that we took lightly.
That's Del Lambert, the district's transportation director. After a year and a half of work, surveys, route analysis, an electrical update to their garage, Alexandria Bay got 2 electric buses on the road in early March. I'm here because they're the first North Country school district to do so, and we wanted to see what it's really like. Erin Jolly drives one of these buses twice a day on a 20-mile bus route. She says the biggest difference in driving an electric bus is the quiet.
The sound, yes, the sound is a big one. The kids have enjoyed it so far. They have their jokes and whatnot. It's a lot quieter. You can definitely hear the kids in the back of the bus, so there's benefits to that.
Jolly backs one of the buses out.
There you go. That's as loud as she gets.
Yep. It's like a refrigerator hum or something.
We board the bus, and Jolly takes us out onto Route 12. As we approach a big hill, Lambert tells Jolly to stop.
Now, a diesel bus, when you take off from right here, you'll hear that motor rev, and then you'll hear it shift, you'll feel it shift. With these, it's just a straight drive.
So we're at a dead standstill right now, and yep. You're about to go up this hill, and you're saying normally this you would sort of hear the bus working, and
yeah,
it would take a while? Okay.
All right, Erin, go ahead.
According to the state, this is the sound of the future. New York has joined 5 other states requiring a switch from conventional to electric school buses. Here, 100% of school bus fleets must be electric by 2035. In 2027, according to the law as it stands now, districts will no longer be able to buy conventional buses at all. It's a huge transition and a pretty controversial one. It sits at this prickly intersection of climate change politics, the role of government, new technology, and a lot of school districts are hesitant. Dana Wood is with the Lake Placid Central School District. He says that the current range of electric buses, about 120 miles, doesn't work for rural districts like his. They travel far for field trips and sports games.
To Wells, Indian Lake, Bolton Landing, so we can't send an EV bus there.
And he says electric buses are twice as expensive as conventional ones.
When we have to make the switch, we will make the switch, and we may miss out on financial incentives. But for us, we need to purchase a bus that is going to meet all of our needs.
New York Senator Dan Steck says Lake Placid is not alone.
You know, there's a lot of school districts in the North Country that have reached out to me and my colleagues saying, hey, we are not ready to do this.
Steck criticized the state for taking a one-size-fits-all approach, saying that for districts with dense populations, going electric will be easier. Think Long Island, Buffalo, Albany. Steck has joined other New York Republicans in calling for the mandate to be repealed or significantly delayed.
You know, slow your roll on the mandate. Try it in areas that the climate and the nature of the distances of the bus routes is more conducive. You know, learn from that.
Steck says there are just too many unanswered questions to force districts to make this switch right now. About the cold, about the electric grid, about supply and demand.
Just because you're asking questions and saying, hey, I want to make sure that the math works and that we're doing the right thing here, does not mean that you're a climate change denier or you don't love the environment. It's that you respect the safety of school kids, the value of the taxpayers' money.
Of course, the state sings a very different tune. It says electrification is about kids' safety because diesel and gasoline buses idle a lot and emit dangerous pollutants.
Particulate matter, carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides. These are all associated with chronic health conditions like asthma, cancer, and cognitive impairment.
Adam Reuter is the director of NYSERDA's Clean Transportation Group, which is in charge of the state's transition to electric buses. He says this is about human health and the environment. 30% of carbon emissions in New York come from transportation. He says they know that current electric buses may not work for longer range applications, but that they don't have to.
The fact is that the technology is going to continue to improve over the next decade.
And he says they're advocating for a gradual approach.
School bus fleets don't turn over in a year. They turn over a decade or sometimes even longer. What we want people to start doing now is doing a study, figuring out a plan. And then we think it's a good idea for schools to start buying a bus or two now.
Reuter says they'll pay for those studies and the difference in cost, using $500 million from New York's Environmental Bond Act. There's other money, too. The EPA's electrification program, federal tax credits, grants through individual utility companies. And Reuter says they're not worried about a big supply chain blowup. Neither is one of the biggest sellers of school buses in the state, New York Bus Sales. They sell Bluebird buses, which are manufactured in Georgia. Director of Sales Jeremy Johnston says in 2016, Bluebird could produce 4 electric buses per week.
As of January 1st, Bluebird now has the capacity to build 20 electric buses per day on 2 shifts. I mean, we have significantly increased the capabilities. And a lot of that is because of the pending mandate in New York State.
Johnston's office sold Alexandria Bay their electric buses. It's organized trainings for the school's mechanics, drivers, even local ambulances in case of an emergency. Johnston even helped Alex Bay fill out their EPA grant application, which subsidized their first 2 electric buses. They normally run $400,000 apiece. District Superintendent Christopher Clapper says they paid just $95,000 per bus.
So we were able to purchase both buses for less than we could purchase one conventionally fueled bus.
The grant also covered bus chargers and electrical upgrades to their bus garage. He says this is plain economics. Now, were the aid to disappear, Clapper says they'd go back to what was cheaper for taxpayers. As the first district in the region to go electric, Clapper says he's been fielding lots of calls from other districts.
There's a lot of questions out there. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So I think they're calling just for clarity. There's a misconception that you have to build new bus garages to handle the infrastructure. I mean, look at our bus garage. It's a fine garage, but it's not new.
Transportation Director Del Lambert's biggest concerns were about electrical fires and the buses not operating in the cold. He set both of those fears aside after doing some research and visiting a bus operation in Montreal, which has been running electric buses since 2018. And there are serious benefits to electric, too, says Lambert. They pay less to refuel per day, $10 in electricity versus $20 to $30 in gas, and maintenance costs a lot less. No oil changes.
I'd say over a bus lifetime, the maintenance that you save would probably, I wouldn't say it would make up the whole difference between buying the 2 buses, but it would make up a good chunk of it.
He said a lot of the resistance to electric buses comes down to fear.
It's like everybody else. You're always nervous. Everybody, no one likes change. You know, now we're jumping into an electric, fully electric, not a hybrid, fully.
That's a big transition, and the burden is on districts to figure it out. But Lambert says that in the end, even if the Republican appeal to delay the mandate succeeds, electric is still coming.
Whether it comes this year or it comes 5 years from now, it's still coming. So basically, if you're not buying electric buses, you're kicking the can down the road.
By taking advantage of the current grant money, they got the buses for cheap and the infrastructure updates for free. They're ready for 2027 and beyond. Amy Feiereisel, North Country Public Radio in Alexandria Bay.
This story is part of NCPR's new year-long series on climate change. We're diving into how climate change impacts every aspect of our lives in the North Country, from education to recreation, the local economy to local health. If you haven't already, take our climate change survey by going to ncpr.org. It's right there on the front page. Or you can text CLIMATE to 315-978-6277. That's 315-978-6277.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio, 12 minutes past 8. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up, astronomer Eileen O'Donohue joins us in studio to answer your questions about the total solar eclipse coming up on Monday. That's in just a few minutes right here on Northern Light.
Music by Evan Veenstra in Gananoque, Ontario. Weather Service says increasing clouds today, some snow, sleet moving into the area tomorrow and into Thursday as well. Winter storm watches and high wind advisories for much of our region starting tomorrow. Some areas, some of the higher elevations of the Adirondacks and Green Mountains could see as much as a foot of heavy wet snow by Thursday afternoon. This hour's programming is supported by Long Run Wealth, an SEC-registered investment advisor in Lake Placid, providing comprehensive wealth management, retirement, and financial planning solutions, longrunwealth.com, and by Citizen Advocates, enabling people with developmental disabilities to live meaningful, self-chosen, and safe lives since 1975, online at citizenadvocates.net.
Next Monday, April 8th, will be a massive day in the North Country. Most of the region is in the path of totality for the solar eclipse. An estimated 170,000 people are expected to travel to the region. There'll be outdoor festivals in Plattsburgh and Watertown, Tupper Lake and Gouverneur. But there's one group of people that will be forced indoors: prisoners. New York State has issued a lockdown for all correctional facilities during the eclipse. Emily Russell reports.
There are 44 state prisons in New York. Many are in the western and northern regions of the state. That means that many are in the path of totality for next Monday's solar eclipse. But nearly all of the state's more than 32,000 inmates will be inside that afternoon. New York's Department of Corrections and Community Supervision is canceling all visits and programs and enforcing a lockdown from 2 to 5 p.m. on Monday.
Canceling all these programs and keeping people in their cells, let alone during this sort of monumental celestial event, seems unnecessary and harmful.
That's Benjamin Heller. He's a senior associate at the Vera Institute of Justice in New York. The state says the three-hour lockdown is part of its effort to ensure the safety of inmates and staff. But Heller says it could have the opposite effect later on.
Even if in the short term a total lockdown means that nothing is going to happen, we know that, you know, facilitating positive experiences and giving people access to recreation and visitation and things like that is a way to reduce violence, not just among incarcerated people, but towards staff as well.
The state's Department of Corrections declined to be interviewed for this story. In a statement, it did say it would provide eclipse glasses to all inmates and staff, though it's unclear how many will actually be able to see the eclipse from their housing units. Meanwhile, in neighboring Vermont, officials say they're planning an eclipse viewing event for at least one prison in the path of totality. In Texas, which is also in the path of totality, prison officials say they're not planning any special events, but they're also not instituting a lockdown. The Federal Bureau of Prisons also said it won't be locking down its facility in the Adirondacks. John Roberts is with NYSCOBA, a union that represents state corrections officers in New York. He thinks New York is just being cautious, considering that there could be a real strain on emergency services and limited cell coverage.
I think they're just trying to take a proactive approach, and 3 hours isn't the end. I mean, there's still wreck inside the dormitories for the medium facilities. Of course, maximum facilities, they will be still, you know, in their cells for that time. But it's not like it's a severe amount of time or a whole day.
Roberts worked at Clinton Correctional in Dannemora. He says allowing incarcerated people outside for the eclipse would be really complicated and potentially dangerous. Some of these facilities, like in Dannemora, have more than 1,000 inmates. Putting them all out in a rec yard at once would come with its own risks. The 3-hour lockdown during the eclipse will also impact prison staff. They'll be required to work wherever they're assigned. Robert says that kind of restriction is just one you get used to when you work in prisons.
Unfortunately, corrections, you know, my 17 years this year I'll have in, I've missed many Christmas, Thanksgiving, New Year's, birthdays, weddings of friends and family over the years because, we said, we're 24/7, 365.
For many incarcerated people and some staff, Monday's total solar eclipse would be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The next time New York will be in the path of totality will be 55 years from now. Emily Russell, North Country Public Radio.
Several women have filed lawsuits alleging sexual misconduct at the Clinton County Jail. The county recently settled with 4 former employees for more than $360,000. Kara Chapman has more.
Over the last year, 4 women have filed federal lawsuits alleging they experienced sexual harassment, discrimination, and retaliation while employed at the Clinton County Jail. They say that treatment ranged from inappropriate comments and threats of rape to undermining them in front of inmates. All 4 women resigned from the jail. They reached settlement agreements with the county in December. County Administrator Michael Zerlo has said the county contributed $50,000. The Albany Times Union reported last week that amount was the county's deductible. The total settlement amount, including what was paid by the insurance carrier, came to more than $362,000. The county legislature has said it settled to avoid the cost of drawn-out litigation. One of the former employees has started a petition calling for Clinton County Sheriff David Favreau to resign. She says, as the leader of the jail, he's to blame for the issues there. More than 600 people have signed the petition since the end of January. 3 other sexual misconduct lawsuits involving the jail are pending in state court. One was filed by a 5th woman who says she also experienced sexual harassment and discrimination while employed there. The other 2 were filed by former inmates who say they were sexually abused while incarcerated at the jail. The Times Union reports the state attorney general's office is investigating workplace misconduct claims at the facility. Kara Chapman, North Country Public Radio.
The state's budget was due yesterday. It's a crucial piece of policy that determines spending on everything from schools to hospitals to environmental management in the Adirondacks. But lawmakers in Albany were not able to agree on a final spending plan by the April 1st deadline. As WNYC's John Campbell explains, a late budget has become somewhat of a tradition in Albany.
Governor Hochul has made pretty clear since she took office in 2021 that she isn't terribly concerned about the budget deadline, quite frankly. I mean, this is her 3rd budget since she took office, and this is the 3rd one that's going to be late. And, you know, there aren't a ton of immediate consequences from that. They did pass a budget extender to essentially fund government through April 4th, and that'll ensure that state workers will get paid, which is the biggest deal on the when the budget runs out. But it, you know, it's a rite of passage in Albany for a late budget. There were some exceptions during Andrew Cuomo's tenure because he tried to make on-time budgets a symbol of government functioning. But, you know, for the most part, dating back to the 70s and 80s, budgets have been regularly late, and that is going to be the case again this year as well.
That was John Campbell reporting for the New York Public News Network. A Mariah man was found dead Monday morning after a shooting in Essex County. State police found 40-year-old William Ball dead inside a vehicle on Lincoln Pond Road in Elizabethtown. He'd suffered a gunshot wound. Police say a preliminary investigation found Ball was involved in an altercation that led to the shooting. The suspect allegedly fled into the woods. Police say there's no threat to the general public. The Lincoln Pond and Simmons Hill roads were closed for much of the day Monday while police investigated Ball's death. Lincoln Pond Road residents are asked to check their security cameras for any suspicious activity. Anyone with information is asked to call state police at 518-873-2777.
It's been a warm winter and early spring in the Adirondacks. There were some weeks with decent conditions for ice fishing, though the higher than average temperatures in March led to unstable ice. In mid-March, two people were ice fishing on Indian Lake in Hamilton County. According to a state press release, it was 55 degrees that day. An environmental conservation officer noticed the deteriorating ice conditions and urged the anglers to return to shore. They tried to walk back, but one fell through the ice and was helped back out from the other angler. The conservation officer found a canoe and got help chipping through the ice from two local firefighters. The anglers were paddled safely back to shore to the shore of Indian Lake. You're listening to Northern Lights right here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up in just a minute, astronomer Eileen O'Donohue joins us in studio to answer our questions about the total solar eclipse coming up Monday. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note coming up at 8:42. But first, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Well, the extended forecast calls for sunshine on Monday, eclipse day. We'll keep our fingers crossed. But we've got some wintry weather moving into the region tomorrow and Thursday. Day, increasing clouds today, and then tomorrow, mixed precipitation, probably some rain during the day, some snow at night, combination of snow and sleet as well. Some areas, according to the Weather Service, especially some of the higher elevations of the Adirondacks and Green Mountains, could see as much as a foot of new snow by Thursday afternoon. St. Lawrence Valley, more probably sleet and rain than snow. Again, some of the higher elevations more likely to get snow. Some of the lower elevations and valleys more likely to get rain and sleet. Right now, fair skies, 34 degrees here in Canton.
Well, we put up the bat signal to listeners to ask them what their questions are, what all of our questions are about the total solar eclipse. A lot of us, myself included, never experienced this before. So many of you responded, and we're here with Eileen O'Donohue to get our answers to the about what the total solar eclipse is going to be like. Eileen, good morning. It's so good to see you.
Yeah, well, we haven't had a total solar eclipse here since 1569, so I'm not surprised people forgot.
I know. Yes, after 400 years, you get a little rusty. Yes. Well, I guess we can start off with a question from Sue Rao. Hers is sort of practical. Well, first, she's a diehard Eileen O'Donohue fan.
Oh, that's great.
As many of the listeners who called in were, myself included. But she said, I love to listen to Dr. Eileen O'Donohue all year. But and her question is there a diagram or chart that shows us where the planets will be relative to the sun during totality?
Yes. And actually, with that question, I made one.
Oh, that, right on.
Yeah. And so if you go to my homepage, which is very hard to get through to, through St. Lawrence's regular page, but if you go to http://, you know, the regular, myslu, myslu.stlau.edu/tilde AODO.
Sorry.
All right. Or just we'll Google link to Eileen
it.
O'Donohue.
We'll make sure to link to it.
But
at
any rate, I have a PowerPoint presentation linked there about this solar eclipse. And so among the things that I show on that are when we've had eclipses before in the North Country, and particularly in Canton. I mean, it varies across the North Country. I've been to Watertown, I've been to Lake Placid, I've been to Alex Bay, and actually the last solar eclipse and the next solar eclipse are different in each one of those places. But here in Canton, our last solar eclipse was in 1569, and the next one is in 2399. So this is a one opportunity in 830 years. So it's one in 10 lifetimes.
Mm.
It's not one in one lifetime. So if you go to that and you grab that PowerPoint, then on slide 28, I have a map of the sky. Now, the software I use for showing the eclipse doesn't really do a great job of getting the darkness of the sky correct.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I have one that doesn't show much because it has the sky too bright. But then I have one where I've just turned the atmosphere off. And so the sky is dark and you can see the eclipse sun. And, I mean, all the naked eye planets will be out. Farthest in the upper left is Uranus, then Jupiter, then Mercury, then the eclipsed sun, and then Venus, and down to the lower right, Saturn and Mars. And, of course, if you look down, you can usually see Earth. So that's one you can pick out.
My gut reaction was, wow, how incredible.
And then I pointed out some stars that are out there. An asterism called the Great Square of Pegasus is four bright stars in a square. And that will be up and just right of the eclipsed sun. So we might be able to see that. And then a bright star down to the south is one called Deneb Kaitos, which is a fun name to say. But people looking for planets might say, oh, what's that? Oh, no, that's a star.
That's part of the summer triangle.
The summer triangle is
never mind.
Is not there yet.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. Yes, but we'll make sure to link to that PowerPoint on our website,
yes.
ncpr.org.
Okay.
We also got a question from listener Ted Skomsky in Rochester.
Hi, I'm Ted Skomsky. I live in Rochester, New York. My wife and I both grew up in the North Country, and we get up there frequently because we have friends and relatives still in the Messina, Raymondville, Norwood, Norfolk area. I was wondering how long astronomers have been able to predict eclipses. I think I've heard they've been able to do this for centuries. Also wondering how they've been able to predict solar eclipses without our modern tools.
Actually, you know, the sky has been really important to people. And that's why we've built structures like Stonehenge, Machu Picchu. Mm. And, you know, the hardware store didn't used to give away calendars. They had to build Stonehenge. Mm. And so it's so important to us, the sky, the sun. And so we have been able to predict eclipses for millennia. The Babylonians and the Chinese could predict them by about 2,500 years ago. And, you know, there was an eclipse in the North Country in, I think, 1142, that the peacemaker saw, that was part of the creation of the Confederacy. So we've been able to predict them. People have been very good observers. Mm-hmm. Lining, you know, if you have a long line of sight and you line up a couple of things, our eyes have been able to map the sky to great detail. And we've inherited these maps, but the Greeks had fantastic maps of the sky. So we have been able to predict them, and they worked out the mathematics of it. Yeah. So, and now, I mean, we just use a lot of math to do it. Right. It's much easier with computers than it was with Roman numerals, but we have... We have figured it out. So people have known this for a long time.
Yeah, you said even, I saw in your note, even back to like the Babylonians, the
Chinese.
Yes,
2500 BCE. So that's 5,000 years ago. Yes.
Well, we do have another question from someone we all know and love, special guest star Lucy Grindin.
Hi, Eileen.
Hi, how you doing, Lucy?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great.
So my question comes from a conversation I had with my colleague, Catherine Wheeler.
And our friend, Catherine Wheeler.
Our friend, Catherine Wheeler, yes. She had a source tell her that one of his dreams of life is to go on an eclipse cruise, like go out on a boat into the ocean to see an eclipse. And when I thought of watching an eclipse from a boat, I suddenly thought, could you chase one? Like, how fast would you have to go to stay in totality for longer than 3 minutes to sort of chase the totality?
Well, you could stay in it maybe for a little longer than 3 minutes, but the moon's shadow moves across the Earth at anywhere from 1,500 miles an hour on up. And so when it's passing over Canton on Monday, it'll be going at 2,500 miles an hour. So I don't know of any boats that can move at 1,500 miles an hour, or airplanes. Even our fighter jets can't move that. That's Mach 3.5. I don't know what the fighter jets can get to, but the boats certainly can't do that. And so you could stay a little longer if you're moving in the direction of the eclipse, of the shadow, but you're not going to be able to stay in it for forever. And there are a lot of eclipse cruises. Just Google it. And so I got clouded out for totality in Kansas in 2017, and I'm hoping for these clear skies here. But I may be looking for an eclipse cruise so we can move to where there aren't clouds. That or I'm going to Australia in 2028. They are going to have a great one across the outback. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Lucy. Well, and we got another question after I sent you the list of questions from listeners. So I know you haven't gotten a chance to think about it ahead of time, but I really appreciated it. It's from Maria Smith in Plattsburgh. I think she works at Mountain Lake PBS. And she asked, what specific phenomena or rare occurrences during a solar eclipse are astronomers really excited to observe and study? And what could those observations teach us about our solar system and beyond?
Well, they teach us about the sun, which is like the most important thing in the solar system.
Yeah.
But one of the phenomena that we enjoy watching is one that happens just before totality, when you have a very thin shaft of sunlight left, just a bare arc of the sun is left, and you get these shadow bands that are very fleeting, and I've been told, I haven't seen them, I have been told that when you see them, they're very obvious, but they're really hard to photograph. Yeah. And what they're due to, it's the same phenomenon that creates the geometric patterns on the bottom of a swimming pool when you're looking at it in sunlight. And you see there are these little geometric shapes, and they're kind of rainbowy on the edges, and they move around. They don't stand still. And those are due to, there's variations in the density of the water. As the sunlight comes through the water, through the different levels, it gets bent and, you know, turned, you know, distributed into the colors and things like that. And that happens. We're standing in a swimming pool. We're standing on the bottom of an ocean of air. Mm. But they're so subtle, those little geometric shapes, even though they're passing over us all the time, we can't detect them. And you can see them if you look at a star and you see it twinkling. Mm. That twinkling is because those little boundaries of those little geometric shapes are passing by you, and you see some colors, and you see some brightness, you know, brightens and dims. And so just as you have a thin shaft of sunlight, we're going to be able to detect those little geometric patterns on the bottom of the pool. And so this is our opportunity to see the full corona of the sun. Yeah. And we don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know what the prominences are going to look like on the edge of the sun. And so it's very exciting to see the full corona. And there's not just astronomy in there. We're also, there are biological experiments. People are looking at animals. They are looking at the weather, how the temperature changes. It gets about 10 degrees cooler under the shadow. Yeah. And so they're looking at all of these changes because it is a big event. Totality is night in the middle of the day, and everybody responds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It does. Yeah, one listener, Andy Sager in Plattsburgh, he described those, for the first part of your answer, shadow bands, just like these rolling, undulated, like it just like looks like the earth is just sort of rolling towards you. Like he described almost like an earthquake kind of feel.
Yeah, it's people get kind of disoriented with this optical phenomenon. I really am looking forward to seeing it.
Yes. Well, we also heard Steve Baldwin out of Potsdam. Listener Steve Baldwin, he sent in quite a few questions, and smarter minds than me could understand the kind of questions that he had, but they're really interesting. I think the first one that we could start with is: are solar eclipses associated with a certain phase of the moon, like the new moon?
Well, yes, a solar eclipse can only happen at new moon when the moon is directly between the Earth and Sun. That's when we have a solar eclipse, because the moon's shadow falls on the Earth, so it's got to be between us and the Sun. And then a lunar eclipse only happens at the full moon because the Earth's shadow falls on the moon. So the moon's got to be the opposite side of the Earth from the Sun. And, you know, people wonder, why don't we have them more often? It's because the moon's orbit is tilted with respect to the Earth. So most of the time, the full moon and the new moon are above or below the plane of the Earth and Sun. So the shadows of the two worlds don't fall on each other.
Yeah.
It's only when the moon is crossing Earth's orbit, and so it's at a position called a node, where the moon's orbit crosses Earth's, and when it's at that position and at new moon, then we can get a solar eclipse. When it's at that position and at full moon, we can have a lunar eclipse. And so last weekend, we had a lunar eclipse. Nobody really heard much about it because the moon was actually a little bit above the plane of the Earth and Sun. So it only went through the part of the Earth's shadow where the Sun was partially blocked. Mm-hmm. And I got up at 1:30 in the morning and looked at it, and you couldn't tell. That's why I told people, don't get up. All right? So that happened 2 weeks ago or a week ago. And now we're looking, you know, we just had the last quarter moon last night. So we're headed, the next phase is the new moon. And we're going to know exactly when the new moon occurs because we're going to have this eclipse.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. Oh, he was curious, too, if a second solar eclipse could occur the day after a solar eclipse.
Nope, because the moon, it crosses the plane of the Earth and Sun, and then it just continues in its orbit. You know, it has no idea it's causing an eclipse. It is just doing its job orbiting the Earth. Thank you very much. And so it's just continuing, and it gets farther away from the line between the Earth and Sun, and we have to wait for it to come around again.
Well, and he was wondering, too, is there such a thing as an eclipse season?
Yes, because the moon's orbit is tilted, and it keeps that tilt as the Earth and moon go around the Sun. And so those two nodes where moon's orbit crosses Earth's, you can draw a line between those. And when that line points toward the Sun, then the new moon and the full moon can both be at a node. And so right now, that line of nodes points at the Sun in October and April. Back in 2017, it pointed in August and, I guess, late February and August. So it moves, that position, that line kind of precesses. It rotates around over a period of about 9 years. Mm. So over 9 years, the eclipse season moves through the full calendar. So there are eclipse seasons. Right now, it's April and October.
Okay. Oh. Interesting.
Cool beans.
Yeah, cool beans.
It's all these patterns. Saturns that people don't know about.
No idea.
The ancient people knew all of these. Oh, and somebody asked about a Soros cycle.
Oh, that was me. Yeah.
And it's that's really complicated. It has to do with the geometry of the Earth, Moon, and Sun in their motions repeats. And they're very long periods. And so if you want to get into it, we can get into it. Yeah. But we can't do it in 2 minutes on the radio.
We'll grab a beer sometime and talk about Soros cycles. One question I did want to ask, though, in the couple minutes that we have left is, what are eclipses like on other planets?
They're not as special as Earth because what we have this just incredible, amazing coincidence that the sun is 400 times bigger than the moon and it's 400 times farther away. So the moon and sun are on Monday will be almost exactly the same size in our sky. And so we get to see the full corona. And on Jupiter, the moons, Io and Europa and Ganymede and Callisto, they cast their shadows on the planet. But those moons are so close that they just blot out all of the sun and the corona. They don't get to see the corona. And, you know, the Jovians who are hanging out in the clouds watching these eclipses, they're just like, it blots out the whole sun like your hand. You know, you can make an eclipse of the sun with your hand, and it's not very exciting. And that's what the eclipses are like on Jupiter. So ours is particularly exciting just because they fit so perfectly well. And it's just an awesome, awesome situation that we get to enjoy.
That's just magnificent that's true.
It is.
And I did want to get to, I know Steve Baldwin had another question. This is the one that I was having a hard time following, but you said that you really got it. But does the inclination of the moon's orbit around the Earth with respect to its ecliptic plane always face in the same direction? And if not, then does the direction change in a way that is cyclic?
Yes. So that's asking, so the tilt of the moon is as it goes around, as it and Earth go around the sun, does it maintain that same angle? And for a given year, yes. But over 9 years, that angle precesses, that plane wobbles around the full circle. And so over 9 years, that plane changes by 180 degrees. So over 18.6 years, it changes by 360 degrees.
Excellent.
And so it's stuff like that that comes into the Soros cycle.
Right. For that beer later.
With a chalkboard.
Goodness. Yes. I do want to touch base with Todd since we're when we should wrap up the show, Todd, because it's 8:42:30, and I know we got to play Bird Note at some point. And what do you think?
Let's go 2 more minutes.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
One more
excellent.
Question.
Lucy has one more question. Come on, girl.
Okay. Yeah. So I learned one time that the moon is sort of very, very slowly leaving the Earth.
Yes,
very,
it is.
Very, very slowly.
Yes.
And that it would have appeared bigger in the sky back in the time of the dinosaurs. And
oh,
it'll be
yes, it was much bigger. So they didn't get nearly as good an eclipse.
Yeah, so when did it become so perfect for us to see the corona, and when will it be, you know, too small?
Yeah, well, I don't know, like, the exact millennia when that happened. I mean, it's been at this distance. It's moving away from the Earth 3 centimeters a year, and this is because of the tidal interactions between the Earth and the moon. And the moon, by the way, is slowing the rotation of the Earth 1.2 microseconds per century, so the days are getting longer. But it is slowly moving away. We're getting more annular eclipses, but it's happening very slowly. I mean, it's got to change a significant amount. You know, it's a 25,000-mile difference between the moon at perigee, where we have a total eclipse, and apogee, where we have an annular eclipse. And so it's got a few thousand miles to go, and at 3 centimeters per year, it's going to take a while. And so, yes, we are in a perfect time. And, you know, 10 millennia down the road, they'll only have, or 20, I don't know how many millennia, I'm guessing, but they'll only have annular eclipses. Mm. So we need to enjoy this one for generations, you know, for the 5 generations before us and the 5 generations after who won't get to see this total eclipse in the North Country. It's our burden to enjoy it most thoroughly.
Yes.
And get the kids out of the basement. Make sure they watch it.
Put down
no
your
phones.
No phones. Just enjoy it. Just experience it. Just look at it.
Pay attention to the air, to the bugs, to the animals, to the people around you, to your own mind, the lizard in the back of your head who's terrified.
Yeah. Eileen O'Donoghue, thank you so much for coming on to answer all of these questions.
I love it. And thank you to everybody who enjoys listening to me, because I certainly have a lot of fun talking.
I think everybody we talked to was going that. They're like, tell Eileen, we're so excited. We love hearing her.
That's great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.